For a cyber conference, my IT sophistication is pretty low, so I guarantee I'm going to turn this off at least twice during the presentation accidentally, so just bear with me a little bit. Also, they set me up right after lunch, and then they put me in a warm room here, and then they had me talking about insurance just to guarantee everyone falls asleep. So please, I want to make sure this is, you know, a discussion that if you have any questions, really I set this up to kind of hit on some key points to facilitate the discussion, but this is really intended to be, you know, an ask the lawyer forum where you can kind of raise your questions and we could use that as a jumping off point. So I'll start just kind of hitting. I was right there with you that most of what Max said I didn't actually understand, but what he did say that I understood has scared the hell out of me, so right there with you. So where do we start? Kind of as we think about risk and we think about insurance, and where we start is kind of the inherent uncertainty in which we all exist. Over the last 5 to 10 years, the healthcare delivery models and the reimbursement models have changed dramatically. And if anyone could tell me, you know, where it's going here in the near future, I want you to pick out my lottery tickets, because it's one of those where we're kind of living in this eternal state of uncertainty on kind of what's going to happen. What is pretty clear is we've transitioned from, you know, kind of historical cost base to now it being based more on accountability and quality, and that's likely to continue, but exactly what that means and this precise context, still quite uncertain. So the uncertainty has led to a tremendous amount of provider consolidations, both systems, you know, acquiring other systems, hospital consolidation, and a tremendous amount of physicians that are now employed. That, you know, big push probably a couple years ago, especially with the employees, still continuing today. You know, how long that'll continue, I don't really know. I mean, there's still some organizations out there looking for strategic partners in order to, you know, help with the bottom line. But I think a lot of that is probably behind us just based on the volume that occurred, you know, a couple years ago. You know, it's interesting because the physician groups, I work with a number of physicians, hospitals, healthcare organizations, and health plans. And I think a number of the physicians were kind of thinking, the uncertainty is bad. I need to go in-house right away because I can't tell what this is going to do for me. And I think that happened, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And today, some were looking, saying, was that right? Was it as uncertain as I thought it was going to be? Medicare didn't really change the reimbursement in a way that I thought it was going to, that it was really going to decrease and hurt us in a way that I just didn't anticipate. So I think a lot of them are kind of looking and saying, you know, it's worked out, but it certainly didn't play out exactly as I thought. And actually, just taking a step back, I apologize for jumping right into it. A little bit about me. I don't have the great background that Mac has, which is probably why I try to streamline right into the presentation. I'm a partner at Honigman Miller Schwartz & Cohn. We're a general business law firm. We have an expertise in the insurance and particularly the captive insurance market. I've been working in that for 8 years, going into my 9th year. So my specialty is really helping organizations coordinate their coverage, both on the traditional insurance side and then on the self-insurance side, whether that's, you know, in a self-insurance trust or in a captive insurance company. So my practice really revolves around a number of kind of different types of healthcare organizations or health plans, trying to figure out the best way to strategically structure their commercial and self-insurance programs. So continuing here, what we're seeing a lot of is, in this evolving market, developing broader networks, more joint ventures, and more accountable care or accountable-like care-like organizations. I've heard accountable care so many times that the reality is very few of them are true accountable care organizations. It's just accountable care-like, which people are using to kind of reference a broader network of integrated delivery services. So impact on risk, what has really changed? You know, in the healthcare delivery side, we can get into some of the details. I know the emphasis here is more on the plan side, but really not a whole lot in kind of the overall types and nature of risk. So it's more been kind of greater emphasis on data and technology. But for the plans, that's really always been our main source of risk. It's the data that we have. So there has been a ton of change regarding the specific types or nature of the risk. It's just been an increased emphasis on the risk that's always been the most relevant to us. The magnitude, that's kind of the bottom part there. It's one of those that the magnitude is the one that's really changing, and that's the one that's really difficult to keep up. And just kind of general information, that none of this should be, you know, surprising. You all know this, you all live with this. The volume of data being produced is significant and is increasing on an annual basis to the point where you see 44 more times by 2020. So it's one of those where this issue is going to continue to get worse. It's not something we're going to see any relief in the near future. You know, paperless, everything's happening at a rapid pace, and you could see what's happening with the data breaches. You know, increasing the number, 150 in 2005, 800 by 2014. So it's one of those where as the data is increasing, almost just as a matter of necessity, the breaches are also increasing. What else has changed? Historically, kind of transitioning into the cyber area, I didn't mean to kill the suspense there, that cyber is going to be one of the main focuses on risk and how to address it. What has changed? Historically, it was always kind of a financial sector issue, that the data in the banking sector, that was constantly thought of as the most relevant, the most valuable. So this was really one that hit the banking sector a number of years ago, but is now expanding to all sectors. A lot of times you can't plan things around a conference like this, but it was nice of Equifax to really hit us with a really relevant timing on the breach to facilitate our discussion here today. But you know, it's now, you know, as the world has gone paperless and there's more data, there's really not an industry sector that's spared. It's across all industry sectors. And then with that, the greater public awareness. You know, I don't know if anyone's turned on the TV or the news, but we've gotten some relief from the political discussion, and now we're all talking about the Equifax breach, what it means. And that's really the coverage. When the Target breach hit, when the Home Depot breach hit, you know, the big health system breaches, the Anthem breaches, it's one of those, there's more significant news coverage, and as a result, there's much more awareness in the public sector. And also the increased enforcement efforts. So already I've heard with Equifax, 40 states have initiated reviews. They're going to be testifying in front of Congress. And there's already been identified the problem with the breach, which I'm guessing they're going to have a difficult time explaining on that one. So it's one of those where it's across all industries. There's more coverage, so there's less ability to hide from the issue than there was in the past. And on the insurance program, this kind of gets back to one of my points earlier on kind of what's changed, what do you think about what's changing with respect to the types of coverages. And you know, it's a typical attorney answer, but it depends. Kind of deciding what you need to cover and how much, it really depends on the size, complexity of the organization. There's no one size fits all. You know, I have a list of kind of the more traditional coverages that, like I said, not a whole lot has changed with respect to the nature of the risk. So as a result, there hasn't been a whole lot of tremendous change in the types of coverages. So your GL, your D&O, your E&O, property, that all depends on the type of the organization. How much property do you have? And then the newer or emerging coverages include the regulatory liability, reputational risk, and privacy, data, cyber. That's obviously the biggest one. And then comprehensive stop loss. We'll touch on that a little bit at the end. Any questions so far on kind of how we got to where we are? Is anyone, you know, is anyone seeing kind of this new emerging risk that you know we didn't have to deal with before, or is it kind of the same risk, just a different magnitude and a different approach we need to take with them?
So more of a question on the magnitude from where we were 10 years ago to where we are today. You know, we've often questioned the fact that, well, maybe these breaches have been occurring all along, just no one was reporting them. You know, so from that magnitude perspective, you know, it paints a very dire picture of look at this trend and look at how bad it is. And I think we're just becoming more aware, which, okay, we're reporting more, but we're becoming more aware. So I think hopefully that will counterbalance the picture and that trend line will level off in the future, we can hope.
I think that's a possibility. But from our side, I guess my question is, does it really matter? As we're thinking about our risk, the fact that there is 100 or 300 people that are also in the same boat, you know, doesn't make it less problematic to us. And I think it's right that we're becoming more aware, and as a result, there's more reports, and maybe that steadies out. It's possible, But I don't know that that's going to mitigate the damages that are going to be involved, especially from a reputational risk perspective. And that's one of the more difficult ones. The breaches are going to happen. It's one of those where, you know, you can have the best systems in the world and the best oversight. It's going to happen. It's really being able to control the outcome and the response. And the wild card is the reputational risk. I think people have probably seen it. It was immediate, the reaction to Equifax. And the reaction was, I didn't have control over them having my information. It's kind of something that happens completely without, you know, my knowledge or consent. People pull this information. And I certainly didn't have any consent or ability to control who they gave my information to or sold it to. I just know that I get a bunch of spam, you know, things in my mail talking about I'm qualifying for this credit card. And so when that happened and the breach happened, there was this kind of mass response saying, you know, what the hell? How does this happen? And if it's out of my control, what can I do about it? And then the immediate thing was, well, you were responsible for doing something about it. You are going to put a freeze on my account so no one can go and open cards. And Equifax was kind of, wasn't sure if it was going to charge people for the freezes or do it for free. And then there was a huge response. And suddenly Equifax said, no, they're free. They're going back. So it's one of those where it's, you know, for something that's been happening, breaches aren't new. The response is still kind of an iffy situation on what you do, how you do it. And it's in large part based on a reaction by the public.
The only other comment I'll make, kind of going to your point, is the one thing that absolutely has scaled with that level of awareness have been the premiums and the questions that get asked. And because, you know, I can remember 5 years ago applying for cyber liability with the organization I was with, didn't even have to answer any questions. Oh, you're with so-and-so. Great company. Here's your policy. Now, we need you to fly to London. We're going to have an interview, and you're going to need to bring this documentation with you, and we're going to go through it together.
Yep.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah. No, and the fact you need to fly to London. That before, it was one where, you know, any and every market, oh, yes, the cyber, we've heard of that. Come on over. Now it's one where it's only the big players that have been involved for a number of years that deal with the catastrophic list, like Lloyd's, that are saying, you know, we have the staffing, we have the manpower, we have the expertise, we're willing to commit resources to this product, so you're going to come see us. It's a different scale. Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah. You can't understand a word they're saying, then they go out to a cocktail lunch and then you're all in rough shape. So the market conditions, this is just a little bit of a step back, just kind of set the tone on where we are. And where we are is an incredibly soft market. It's if you look at it historically, the insurance market is cyclical. That you normally have a soft market, which is, you know, what does that mean? It means availability of coverage, that you can get coverage, it's affordable, and the terms are reasonable. So what you'll see is kind of a lengthy period of availability and affordability with declining premiums, and then all of a sudden you'll see this volatile, dramatic spike where it goes up and the coverage is just not there, or if it's there, it's incredibly expensive. And what causes that is, you know, losses, adverse investment experience, and competition driving the premiums down where they should be charging more, but because there's so much capacity, they undercharge, and then eventually it just catches up where their losses exceed their premiums and they can't make it up in investments. So as a result, carriers will leave the market, leaving, you know, less competition, and the ones that are still there have taken so much in the way of historical losses, their only response is to jack up the premiums. So that's every, you know, 8 to 10 years you normally see this cycle, and if you look back, it's pretty regular. So we're in a historically soft market that's been unprecedented as far as how soft it is and how long it is. Last hard market is really generally recognized as 2002. And you think about what's happened since 2002, you know, there's been some significant losses. You know, the Fukushima, you know, reactor, the Sandy, you know, superstorm, you know, just major insurance loss events that someone was saying, well, you know, with Irma and, you know, the hurricane season here, is that going to impact things? It's possible, but, you know, we're not dealing with anything we haven't dealt with to some extent and in some capacity when you look at some of the loss events that have occurred. And what you're getting is it's soft because the Warren Buffetts of the world are still viewing insurance as, a good market to increase capital, have the investments, and increase their bottom line. So as long as there's that capacity, you're not going to see a ton in the way of a hardening of the market. And with that, kind of in the PL context, we've seen record-setting batch claims paid out. The non-FDA-approved devices, the OB-GYN that was also an amateur photographer. You have a lot of these cases that are paying out, $200 million, still not really affecting the market in a way that you'd think. So soft market. So even in the soft market, that doesn't mean everything's soft. There are some hard patches. And with that, work comp. That's a market where carriers are taking losses and the premiums are increasing. In particular in the healthcare, the needle sticks, things along those lines, you're seeing a lot in the way of work comp increases. Seeing a lot of programs looking to take higher and higher deductibles to keep their spend down. And what's amazing is I get in the meetings and people are saying, well, our work comp, it really hasn't changed, or if it's gone up, it's gone up a little bit. I said, sure, how many claims are you submitting? Oh no, we don't submit any claims. I was like, so you're just paying those. I said, so you're keeping them artificially low. I said, you're doing a great job at that. I said, but if you're looking for a true read on what your premiums would be if you were actually submitting things to the carrier that's supposed to be paying them, that's the apples to apples comparison. But work comp is a rough one. Cyber, obviously. We'll get into more detail on kind of what's happening there. D&O, particularly in the antitrust, there's more, there's more the class action regulatory covers. There was the nurse wage hour. Those were a bunch of claims going around on those. Affordable professional liability, especially in particular areas and counties known to be heavy hitters in that. And then property coverage in certain regions, i.e. Florida. Again, it's cyclical. If they have a bad hurricane season, suddenly you can't get property coverage. Then after a few years, it goes back to normal. So these are kind of hard pockets in a soft market. Cyber. That has been one of the overwhelming challenges. I can talk a little bit about, professional liability, especially for the providers, some of the provider side, but cyber has really been one of the biggest challenges. And here are the problems. Before, you get every carrier saying, oh yeah, cyber, it's fine. It's, what you do, come on over. I'm already selling you GLPL. What's one more liability? Now, there's carriers that are saying, the losses are astronomical. I can't figure out what the risk is or what the liability is. That is, technology is changing at such a rapid rate, the carriers can't figure out how to underwrite it. So a lot of them are saying, this is not the market for us, and it's forcing people to go over to London and some of the other carriers that are larger, longer term participants. And as a result of that, there's not the competition that keeps the premiums low. The cost is high, so even if you're able to find it, the premiums have skyrocketed. Higher retentions. The carriers are looking to get away from the first dollar. The farther they can get away from first dollar, the more protected they are from a loss. Now, in the cyber world, here's a concern. In PL, professional liability, general liability, even D&O, the vast majority of the claims hit a layer that's, 100, 200,000, 300,000, or they're just the nuisance claims that you settle out and you don't even really submit. They don't hit the... In cyber, there's not a ton of kind of mini breaches. If it's a breach, it's normally death by 1,000 cuts based on the access to the information and the number of individuals affected. So it's one of those where seeing where those retentions go will be interesting, because it's not one where they could say 100, 200, 300,000. It's a couple million before they really distance themselves from a loss. That a $500,000 retention is not going to do a whole lot, because most of the cyber breaches fit into a category where they easily exceed that just based on some of the notification requirements. And here's the one that's really my biggest emphasis. Carriers imposing substantial conditions for coverage, either by virtue of the policy terms or in the application. So there's been, 2015, there was a case, Columbia Casualty and a carrier in California, where essentially there was a breach, And in the investigation, the Columbia settled it. It was $4 or $5 million settlement, which Columbia paid under a reservation, turned around and denied coverage based on a representation in the application that there was certain minimum security standards maintained. And when they went back and said, listen, you indicated that these security standards were maintained, they weren't. And therefore, you lied on your application and it nullifies coverage. And it's one of those where that's a problem, because it's either in the application, there's certain exclusions in a lot of the policies that say you have to maintain these minimum standards. You know, computers must be encrypted. You have to have these login criteria. There's a lot of things that are included in policies that, you know, the people that are buying the insurance may not be fully aware of whether those are compliant. And I can tell you, when you get in front of you and you're signing off on 20 different insurance certificates, paying attention to specific criteria and conditions precedent is not an easy thing to do. So that's becoming more and more relevant, because what is happening is carriers are sustaining losses. Like I said, they're trying to figure out a way to mitigate their losses. So they're bumping up the retentions and they're including more significant exclusionary language. And if you're not paying attention to what that is and making sure you're satisfying them, essentially you can end up in a situation where you have a breach and that's when you find out you didn't have the conditions met. So essentially you were buying nothing at all.
Just kind of a follow-up to that, what do you see organizations doing relative to the gap in terms of, it's unusual to see organizations in the legal department have cybersecurity experts, and so when you get into those terms and conditions, at least for me as a day in the life of being a CISO, you know, I'm playing an attorney even though I'm not one on TV.
You stayed in a Holiday Inn Express last
night. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I'm just curious your experience with that and what you're seeing organizations do other than doing what I'm doing, which is just partner with legal, and we kind of review those things together and kind of jointly come up with T's and C's that protect us and our interests.
So we didn't even coordinate this. That's the second time Aaron's kind of teed me up for a discussion. It's one slide ahead, but I think we should get to it now because it's relevant. And that is the coordination in an organization between risk, IT, and legal. As I said, you know, there's not a whole lot changing with respect to the nature of the risk. That's in the health plan side, that your data has always been the most relevant thing you have. In the healthcare, in the hospital and healthcare system side, it is changing. What they were most concerned about, and still are to a certain extent, is the, you know, professional liability, the quality of care, because that's where they've been dinged most frequently. Cyber is now just kind of a recent phenomenon based on the fact that it's kind of raising to the level of PL. There was always HIPAA, so everyone was kind of always aware of, okay, data, I need to be careful. But now even HIPAA in a new, you know, media-friendly world is dramatically different. So what I'm seeing is I'm in meetings, and in these risk meetings, it's the risk manager and sometimes the finance person. And, you know, finance is in there because the risk manager ends up, spending money and they need to figure out how that coordinates with the budget. And one of my questions is always, as a risk manager, if one of your most significant and evolving risks is cyber and it is IT, how do you possibly manage that risk unless you're an IT expert? And it's one of those where that is one of my biggest pushes is, hey, you know, someone says cloud to me, I'm paying attention to what's going on with the weather outside. I recognize that. So my best friend is an IT person. If I'm in risk management and one of the most concerning and evolving risks is cyber, there is an IT person on my staff. And I don't do anything in that context without making sure I understand, what do we have in place? Is this criteria they mention in the policy or in the application, are we satisfying that? Can we satisfy that? Is this limited enough based on what you assess in the way of how much data we have and what the cost would be? The IT person may not be able to help evaluate that, but at least they can give you information that as a risk person, you could try to translate that into what that means to the organization and what that may mean to a relevant insurance purchase. So that's that side. And there's two ways to mitigate risk. First, to mitigate risk, you have to understand it. That's always the case, no matter how you're trying to mitigate it. So part of it is, what insurance do I buy? Making sure the risk manager is coordinating. The other part is on the legal side, because there's insurance and then there's indemnity. trying to figure out as you're looking at these contracts if more and more involves cyber risks or data risks. A lot of your risk can come, you know, that's going to be the next section, not from what you do, but from what someone else does. So if you're engaging in contracts where you're exchanging information or you're using someone else's system or they're using your system, there's two things that are incredibly important. One, the person reviewing that contract should know enough to think, okay, what are the things I'm trying to identify as a legal representative? What are the concerning things to me? Part of it is kind of the business terms of the contract, but part of it is the risk, and that risk includes the cyber piece. Figuring out, okay, if there is a breach, who's going to be responsible? Whose insurance is going to apply? Are we going to be listed as an additional insured on your policy? Because if there is a breach on this and it arises out of your software, we want to make sure that we're covered, that it's not going to be our policy in play, or our policy may not cover us based on what the nature of the participation is. So it's one of those where historically there have been distinct departments. There has been a risk department, there has been a legal department, and there has been an IT department. That doesn't, that can't work anymore. And really, the way healthcare has changed, those silos don't work generally. That it's now all integrated care. So kind of everything is together. So to have these silos that don't coordinate very well, it really presents significant problems. And I can tell you, when there's a breach, suddenly people are recognized and saying, oh, I thought you had it, I thought you had it. Ultimately, it's not going to matter who had it because no one had it. So no, that is a real problem. And making sure the people responsible for various things include the right expertise is critical, because this is not a world where you can just have one expertise and just run with it, because it requires a number of different specialties. And if you're an expert in risk, you know, risk management in a healthcare or health plan context, and you're also an IT expert, I question what you do because you have too much time on your hands. It's just not possible. It's just not possible to be an expert in all those things. So if you can't, and it's just, you can't be an expert in all those things, you need to make sure you staff your team appropriately.
Hi, I wanted to ask a question about the application process. We've been getting cyber liability coverage for maybe 8 years or so, and the questions are very sort of unsophisticated.
Yep.
There'll be a question, you know, do you have access management protocols in place? Yes or no? So our approach is we try to answer honestly. We try not to offer information that's going to make them go on some kind of fishing expedition. But what I'm wondering is, if we answer yes to something, is that being taken as a representation that, A, we have it across every single possible system and every scenario where you might have access management, and B, is it a representation that we're going to have it forever from this day till the end of this policy period?
It's being taken as a representation to whatever is most advantageous for the insurance company, depending on the situation that arises. The questions are posed that way for two reasons. One, they're not sophisticated to know what exactly the question means or what the answer is intended to solicit. And two, it's ambiguous because it gives them more of an opportunity that if a significant breach comes up, they can turn around and say, well, you represented this. You know, that's inaccurate based on what we've experienced and what we've seen.
But doesn't that go both ways? If we answered yes and it's true, I mean, I guess you're just going to be in an argument in litigation
exactly,
at that point.
That's exactly right. And you're with an argument with an insurance company that, in a lot of cases, has significant resources to push you on that. So it's, you know, it's why I've, not to pick on Lloyd's, I've not seen a really detailed Lloyd's policy. And it's one of those where you ask them about it, and it's like, oh, yeah, no, it's fine, it's covered. And it's one of those where that may be the right, and it's certainly what the broker's saying as he's telling you, but in large part, it's because they have a ton of money, and if they get in a dispute, they know they can outlast you. So it's one of those where it's important to take a look, and while you don't want to get into the habit of every time, you know, you're checking yes, no, you know, it depends, you don't want to be writing explanations, what I would say is make sure you're coordinating with your brokers and your counsel to say, listen, here's what we have. You know, we check this. Do we put something in the file that basically says, this is our understanding, the question isn't, you know, ultimately clear, or is it one where it's so unclear we really need to fight the battle up front, because if we wait, it could turn into a significant battle down the road. It's balancing those interests. You don't want to fight all of them up front, because that'll just lead to the carriers. The carriers are used to people checking it and not fighting them. So anyone that asks questions is immediately suspicious in their mind. So that's kind of the balance on, do we need to get clarity on this? Is it a significant enough item where we could see a dispute coming up? And if so, is it worth fighting now? So taking a step back, kind of, even when cyber is purchased, what exactly, I mean, there's still consideration. That is absolutely, if you manage to find it, you manage to find it at a good price, that's still not the end of the inquiry. How does the organization evaluate what limits are sufficient? I can't answer that for you. And quite frankly, I think a lot of you, my guess is you're struggling to answer it for yourselves. Kind of what is sufficient? If it's a massive breach, are any limits going to be sufficient? It's one of those where we're in a world right now of trying to figure out what the upper limit is on a potential, you know, breach. It's not easy. So it's one of those where you kind of have to take into account a number of factors. That is, what data do we have? What is a worst case scenario in the breach? How many people could be affected? What is the notice response requirement? You know, try to get an estimate of that and figure out, okay, if it's 100 million, does it really make sense for us to buy that? Or is it one where after 50 million, we're in real trouble, you know, from a financial statement perspective anyway? And then also it helps to poll, you know, your brokers or your other service providers to say, okay, we're buying this. What are other similarly situated organizations? Because that helps test your math a little bit. To say, we looked at it this way, we've evaluated this way, we have similar size and presumably data systems as, you know, organization B, C, and D. They're in our market, what are they thinking about it? And then you can identify outliers. You know, if there's someone that's buying half as much, someone that's buying twice as much, you're right in the middle, you know, maybe that means you're thinking about it right. If there's, you know, three other entities that are all buying twice as much, you know, kind of go back to the drawing board, see what you're evaluating, what you may be missing. What exactly is covered? You know, what a breach is or what cyber liability is very much so amorphous. That kind of how breaches are occurring, what's being exposed, kind of what the hack is, it's all changing on a day-to-day basis. So it's very difficult to say what exactly cyber liability is. And carriers don't like that. They like the GL policy that's been the same for 50, 60 years. They don't have to worry about it. They know what it is. Recently, a cyber liability policy, the terms and conditions were brought into, a GL policy was brought into a cyber dispute because there was a cyber breach where essentially information was available online. And the cyber carrier said, oh, look at your GL policy. It includes certain privacy language. And the GL carrier says, well, that privacy language has been in there for 50 years. That's intended to be something entirely different. And the court said, listen, it's unclear enough that you're going to be in this case, at least for purposes of defending. And that's where, you know, even other carriers are getting brought into language that they're not entirely certain what cyber is. They just know they don't want to cover it. So the cyber carriers all kind of have different understandings of what's covered, what's not. Is PCI, you know, the fines and is that covered? Is it not? So it's one of those where just because you buy cyber doesn't mean you're buying the same cyber as someone else. That there is a number of distinctions that you want to be well aware of on kind of what we're buying and is that consistent with what our needs are. This kind of goes back to the prior point. What are the organization's obligations? What are we doing? Do we have minimum safeguards? Do we need to have minimum procedures in place? Is it, you know, if we buy this, are we going to get the benefit of it based on what our obligations are, both with respect to kind of preventative measures and with respect to response measures? You know, that's kind of key on making sure you understand. You know, one of the biggest factors is kind of the breach notification. I haven't worked with anyone to date that has kind of the infrastructure that they could do the notifications themselves. So making sure if you're buying the breach coverage, it includes the infrastructure where basically they have a call center set up where they're making the calls. But it's important, again, to understand kind of what's included in the policy because it's not, you know, they're not template. It's not one size fits all. It's very much fact and circumstance specific. And kind of the last two are related. How does it coordinate with what you do? And how does it coordinate with the other coverages? Just as I said, kind of the nature of what is going on in the health system and the health plan is evolving, it's more integrated, you can't silo it. Coverages are the exact same way. And I've been involved in a number of disputes here recently where everyone issues a policy and is happy to collect the premium, but I'll be damned if there's not a fight every time a claim comes up. And it's important to know kind of what you're buying and what you intended to cover and making sure the language reflects that because D&O, E&O, professional liability, and cyber. There are cases where I've had all those policies involved, and you got four policies involved, but no coverage if you listen to what, you know, what they're saying, because they're all saying, no, not me, them, no, not me at all, but maybe them. So it's one of those where, you know, you look at it. Here's the example, kind of professional liability. Used to be, oh, the doctor did this, the hospital was the employer, vicarious liability. Now, plaintiff's counsels are getting more and more sophisticated. They don't want to do the vicarious liability claim because it requires them to go through a number of steps of establishing it was within their, you know, there's just a number of different steps. So what they're throwing in more and more is the negligent employment, negligent supervision, negligent credentialing, and negligent privileging. Because then they could say, forget vicarious, you're directly liable because you did all these things. You know, looking at that, they say, okay, well, employing, credentialing, privileging, those are mentioned in the D&O policy. Does that suddenly trigger that? Or is it professional liability because they're supervising, credentialing, and privileging in connection with, you know, patient care, and the patient care, you know, patient was injured? Then you look at it and say, oh, well, it is credentialing, privileging, which is D&O, but there's a bodily injury exclusion, so that gets you back over to professional liability. So there's a lot of that going on where, as healthcare is evolving, the coverages are coordinating a way where they didn't have to think that through before, that now it's coming up more and more frequently. I'll get into an example on the cyber and PL in a second, but I want to get to the question.
I was just going to ask, in health insurance, there's sort of a pecking order for coordination of benefits of who's primary and then who's secondary, depending on whether, you know, it's an auto accident, a work injury, your health insurance, do you have a secondary health insurance? Is there any kind of a pecking order within those different coverages you mentioned, or is it just, oh, well, it could be here, and they don't?
It's who's the biggest pain in the ass? I mean, I don't mean to joke, but it's one of those where you get carriers that basically just say, no, we're not paying, and you're going to have to come after us. And then it kind of gets into a dispute with the carriers, which if it's the carriers, that's fine, because as the insured, as long as you have coverage somewhere, they can fight about it all day. But a lot of it comes down to what do the policy terms say? If it's ambiguous, are they going to fight with you, or are they going to, you know, basically play nice with you and fight with each other? And then kind of amongst each other, what do their provisions say on other insurance? More and more other insurance are now getting specific to say, oh, I'm not just going to say other insurance. It's I'm excess of your cyber policy, or I'm excess. That they're really going to significant lengths to try to support their argument that if there's a couple policies in play, they're paying after the other one. So it's really, if you're not doing some of the work on the front side to say, what are we buying this for? Was it intended to cover? Is there overlap? And if there is overlap, are we comfortable with it? Is it almost intentional? Go ahead.
So if you have a benefit of having some upfront preventive by looking at your terms and who you have and all of that, who would you suggest help review those policies before you pay them? Are there brokers out there that know how to do this that are selling this? Or do you have somebody who's an attorney like you do this? Or is there somebody, you know, who would be a good resource for health plans or health systems to use in reviewing what they have and where they have gaps or what would work?
Well, it's perhaps not the most objective response, but it should be an attorney. There's not very many attorneys like me out there, but no. It should be your broker first and foremost, but here's what
most health systems, their primary broker is property and casualty.
Yep.
That's not necessarily expertise you're looking for. And even when you're looking at like review of IT contracts, the recommendation we often give is get somebody who knows IT contracts, because there are terms that you should have in there and what you should be doing to make sure you're not running into the gaps. And I would imagine there's things in these type of policies. I mean, one of the boards I sit on was in an antitrust suit, and now they're in court with the antitrust insurance trying to get them to actually pay out.
Yeah, no, it's I think everyone in this room knows there are good brokers and there are bad brokers. And even the good brokers are being pushed to do more with less nowadays. I mean, the commissions, everything's kind of being cut in a different way and looked at in a different way because there's so much budget pressure. So even the very good brokers are being rushed, and they're not taking the time to think. Really, it is should be a team effort between internal, kind of what your intent is, what you intend to buy, because the service providers can't possibly tell you how the coverages apply unless they know, hey, what's your intent? I mean, they can tell you kind of in a vacuum, this is how they coordinate. But unless they know kind of what your intent for the purchase is, they can't properly advise you. But it should be internal. it should be your broker, and it should be legal. Because from my perspective, when I'm reviewing a contract, I'm not a cyber expert. But what I can tell is what your intent is, where you intended to buy certain coverages, and how those coverages coordinate. And I can also tell that as I'm reviewing a policy, I need to ask someone in your IT department, is this consistent with your practices? Is this going to be enough limits? There's these three criteria. Are you okay with that? And there's this potential overlap. Because I don't understand the practice or procedures. I don't understand how it works. But I can tell you what the insurance policy says and how that will likely be interpreted as applied to your processes.
Are any of you in this room actually doing any of the purchasing of this coverage? And if so, what's the process that you have internally for that type of review? I think Wyatt's going to...
Unfortunately, insurance and reinsurance is a part of my responsibility as finance director. So it always been struggle. We have broker, but we engage our legal department. But primarily, it's kind of work with our broker. And unfortunately, our broker tells us they're not quite sure. So we just go how much we feel. Yeah, that's how much we can afford. We kind of basically feel there's no way we will be finding insurance can 100% cover us, just make us feel comfortable. That's what we're going. That's why I'm sitting here trying to learn something I can take back.
but that actually underscores the point, that it's kind of how much can you afford. But unless you understand kind of what you're buying and what it does and how it relates to your practices, I can tell you I've been involved in multi-million dollar disputes on the back end where some of them have turned out very positive, that we fought with the carrier and they were wrong and they mistreated us, so we got the coverage we need. But it wasn't without spending some money to have that fight. And it's one of those where if you do the comprehensive review on the front end, you're certainly not going to be able to identify every issue because you can't think of every circumstance that may come up. But if you spend a little bit more time and money on the front end doing the review and you prevent a multi-million dollar dispute that you may win or you may lose, I can assure you it's worth the time and effort.
I guess, you know, after I listened to what you present, I think a couple slides before this one, I was concerned because you mentioned the insurance company, the carrier, can say, well, you know, you didn't, you said you had this in your contract, but you didn't have it. I'm like, how am I going to, one, review it? How am I going to know if those IT folks, they put those into it? And how are we going to prove they had it? So I to be honest, I'm still not clear on, like, exactly what process, who are the experts should be involved, engaged in the process of reviewing the coverage, reviewing, like, you know, the contract. How much resource we're going to put in into this process?
It should actually, from both sides, if you think about it the right way, it should actually alleviate your resources. That is, if you get into, so there's two things. Internally, getting risk, legal, and IT on the same page, thinking the same way about risk and how it manifests itself and what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, that should actually save you time in the long run. Because if you're all thinking about it up front, every time legal reviews a contract, every time IT is looking to make a change to the software, implement a new system, or every time risk is looking to broaden or purchase or change the insurance, it's going to recognize the team, hey, looking to do this. And while risk may not understand IT, if risk says they're implementing these requirements, the IT person on the team should say, yep, we can comply with it, we're doing X, Y, and Z, or hey, no, we gotta either push back on that or we need to implement something new. So having that discussion up front, it doesn't take very long, and it gets the relevant expertise in the room. And on the flip side, when you're going out reviewing policies or buying policies, part of it is kind of a point person, which is usually risk, but if you have that internal system, you know where to take it back to, your broker and your legal, not necessarily internal legal, but legal kind of on the insurance side expertise, because they can review and say, all right, what are you looking to do? What do the terms say? And they can give you the relevant talking points and be in that meeting with IT and legal to say, listen, we have a number of different coverages. How do these all, here's the summary. Let me know if you see anything, because I'm going to be required to sign these 20 applications, and having you weigh in before I sign these may certainly present a, you know, prevent a $20 million dispute if we just don't happen to have some of these criteria. Again, you're not going to solve all your issues, but I can tell you if you mitigate 95% of them, those 5% that you're fighting, it makes you look even better, because if you did all the right things, you had all the right processes and procedures, the commercial carrier is going to look even worse as they're trying to fight with you, because you went far, you know, further beyond what a normal organization would do that just signs the things.
I would say, too, I'm a bit skeptical of brokers, because I have been in the seat where I did review all of the insurance contracts from workers' comp, professional liability, cyber, all of it. We had three different brokers, because you typically can't find, for where we're at, you couldn't find one person to do it all. But if a broker told me what he told you, or he or she, I would find another broker. There are better people out there that can give you some guidance, personally.
No, that's absolutely true. It's a matter of figuring out what works for you and developing the right team, both internally and externally. And it's one where, like I said, there's better and worse brokers, and there's brokers that specialize in certain areas. And kind of figuring out if you want to use a single broker that may not specialize in all the areas, or kind of dividing and conquering, I will say there's benefits and risks. That if you get a single broker that's not an expert in all of them, you may not necessarily know what you're getting. You have to pay more attention to the other areas. Or if you use multiple brokers, that coordination is going to be key. Because if broker A's out there buying this insurance, broker B's out buying this insurance, and those policies don't talk to one another because there's two different people buying them, that can be a problem. And let me get back to the example. This is first and foremost on my mind right now, as there's a couple I'll hit on kind of my biggest concerns right now. Cyber and PL. More and more, and this is, you know, kind of getting more into the healthcare side, the provider side, than the plan side, but you know, it gives you the context of how these things could come up in a number of different circumstances. Cyber and PL. More and more healthcare delivery is happening through media, you know, telemedicine, you know, Dr. Oz, those types of things. It's going to get, you know, it's not going to get better. It's going in that direction. You know, Da Vinci robots, pacemakers. And cyber is trying to avoid the expansion of what it covers. So if you look at a cyber policy, it'll define what a cyber event is, a breach, a hack, various things. But it excludes personal injury, bodily injury. So what I'm looking at here is a lot of my healthcare clients, you know, self-insure, have a significant retention on their professional liability. So they're on the hook for a good portion of that, and a lot of them are on the hook for a good portion of cyber. But let's say there's a Da Vinci robot or a pacemaker that's hacked, kills the patient. Absolutely nothing to do with anything the hospital did or the physician did. The professional judgment was, you know, spot on. It was a completely unrelated event that basically, by all definitions, it was a cyber event because it was a hack that caused the injury. But because of the exclusion in the cyber policy for bodily injury, you necessarily have to look for relief in your professional liability policy. And that's a little bit backwards, because it's not a professional liability event. It's inherently a cyber event that caused the loss. It's just the damage. It's a little bit of the tail wagging the dog. But you kind of take that and say, okay, those are the types of coordination issues we have to address. How do we coordinate coverage? Do we push the cyber carriers? Do we just say we're going to cover it in PL? And this is the type of stuff that if you're a provider-owned plan or a provider-sponsored plan, you need to be thinking about, because those types of things, if you're covered in the same policies and programs, you have dramatically different risks when it comes to that. And how those policies coordinate, you know, may make perfect sense on one side, but on the flip side, you look at it and say, oh gosh, that's going to create a problem for us. Should we think about, you know, having an endorsement or a separate policy? Are we on the same network or system? You know, does this even make sense to have the same policy? If we're on the same network and system, maybe it does, because every one of your breaches is going to be, you know, one of ours. But, you know, that's the type of stuff you need to be thinking about when you're buying your coverage. Who's buying the coverage? Is it someone at the system level? Do they really understand what's going on at the plan level? Do they really understand the various risks? So there's a lot of those considerations that I'm finding more and more are not being addressed. It's kind of, oh, we can get insurance, we can buy it. You know, that's kind of it. Fortunately, you know, if the question comes up, yeah, we have insurance. But I can tell you, in each case where there's a breach, and in each case when there's a report, that's the first time people really are starting to realize that they have material coverage issues, that what they thought they were buying is not actually what they were getting. So this kind of gets to...
Well, I was just going to add, you hit on it right there, that I think it's hard to think about what is the best team to have assembled until after you've had a breach and you're going back and reviewing your policy, because we historically were probably too heavily relied upon our broker.
Yeah.
As a lot of carriers do. But in having to go through and have to go through the process of filing a claim, we were learning nuances like they cover breach reporting or they cover credit monitoring, but it's a certain type and only two vendors that you're allowed to use. And you don't really see those nuances when you're just looking at the policy. Plus it's the basic level, which is just like all of these things that you wouldn't identify. So going forward, learning from our experience, one thing that we are going to focus on is having the carrier walk us through, present the scenario. In this scenario, do I have to use legal as a gatekeeper before any next actions that we take? Who would we have to use if we wanted to use credit monitoring? So you're learning all of that in advance,
yeah,
rather than when you're actually applying it, which has been difficult.
No, that's actually phenomenal, because there's been a lot of that going on in the healthcare space, kind of these practice runs. Whether it was the Ebola or the active shooter, it happens all the time on the system side. Why not on the risk side? Run through, and I know there's constant tests of the system, hacking, things like that. Why not run through insurance scenarios? Hey, broker, what happens here? Or hey, insurance carrier, what happens here? Just want to make sure we're prepared. You ask those types of questions, some carriers may say, whoa, what are we expecting something? That's probably going to be their response. But the reality is, no, we're not expecting anything. We just want to make sure we understand how this works, that if we're, buying something, we want to know kind of what we're getting and how it works. So if something does come up, God forbid, we'll know how to progress through it. We can do it efficiently where it mitigates our damages and therefore mitigates your damages. I think that's an excellent exercise.
And then the other piece is involving the people that are actually doing the breach response. So within our organization, it's the privacy team, not necessarily legal. Legal's weighing in, but my privacy team is doing the breach response. So making sure we understand and are involved in the coverage decisions too, because we're the ones on the front line,
yep,
kind of dealing with the cleanup rather than the prevention end of it. So
no, that's excellent. Yeah. I think that's an excellent. Any questions? So this gets a little bit more into what we discussed, having the right team members, assessing your vulnerabilities. It's I heard Mac discuss it. It's difficult kind of to do a self-assessment. So, this is not the point of my presentation is not kind of, the assessments or testing the systems. It's more mitigating the risk. But in order to mitigate the risk, you need to understand it. So understanding where your vulnerabilities may be, getting audits, getting reviews, not of your necessarily of your networks and systems, although that's important, of your processes and procedures around those, your response mechanisms in place. And that's one where there's a number of outside firms, I know most of you are aware of them, but it's also important to make sure when you're doing that, if possible, you're involving legal. And again, that's not because, I like to include self-serving messages, although I do. It's important to do that to make sure you don't have a smoking gun out there, that if you can do it in a privileged context, where you can say, listen, I had this evaluated. This is our attorney doing it. It was developed for the client. It's privileged. It's confidential. Because if you do it in a context that's not protected and you identify an issue, the problem will be if you have a breach, suddenly that issue is, hey, you had this. Again, the Equifax, it was found out that they had an issue. They had the patch for 2 months, didn't implement it. That's a problem. I'm not saying that legal telling you've had it for 2 months will necessarily protect that. That's a fact that's probably going to be obtained regardless. But if you have an audit and you have something that's an evaluation that says, hey, may want to look at this, and it's privileged and protected, the likelihood of that report coming up is much lower than something that you do an audit. It creates an evaluation that you don't address. Suddenly that exercise has actually created more problems than you had in the first place. Okay, so addressing the risk, first and foremost, it's yours. You have to own it. Even if you can get insurance, it's not going to matter. There's reputational risk. You're going to be out there. I mean, there's the major health system just north of here. Significant breach, still reputational risk is significant. So if you have insurance to pay for it, it's still yours. You need to recognize that and say, this will help mitigate the damages of addressing it, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not fixing the issue. So the first thing you need to do is own it. And the second thing is, okay, for what insurance you can buy, figuring out the best way to do it. Pay close attention to the terms and conditions. What are we buying? What's covered? Is it just the response or is it damages? Is it, you know, fines and penalties? Are those insurable in our jurisdiction? There's a number of different things that you need to be considering, and that's where the team-oriented approach, both internal and external, can really come in handy. The coverage overlaps. You know, how does this coordinate with what we're buying? Are we buying too much because there's too much overlap? If there is overlap, do we address that up front and figure out how this would play out in a scenario? That's where the broker and legal exercise would come in play. Say, okay, here's a scenario, here's the breach, or here's this event. What happens? How does this flow through? Tell us where the insurance is. That can be helpful both for understanding and in the event something goes wrong. It's nice to have that in minutes or something like that where you say, listen, this is strikingly similar to a scenario we reviewed with you. Why is this not playing out the same way we anticipated? So, and this gets into the kind of coordination of coverage with cyber, GL, professional liability. Really need to pay attention to those, how they coordinate, and their other insurance provisions. You know, because they'll all say, we don't cover if something else covers. And if they all say that, a lot of times the courts just rule they negate each other out and they're all in. But it still is important to know what's covered in the first place, because if none of them are, you know, applicable, then the other insurance doesn't really matter. None of them are in. And this goes back to the comment earlier. The other insurance, those will be fought aggressively as all get out. None of the carriers want to pay, and they'll fight with each other on the other insurance. Now, most of the time, we're able to remove the insured from it and say, listen, you can fight among yourselves. We don't care, but we're going to get coverage. And then the last piece is try to be as strategic as possible. And this is where your brokers can come into play. Cyber is not attractive right now. You know, the carriers are trying to figure out a way that if they're going to cover it, how do they mitigate their risks? They increase their retentions. They put more substantial exclusionary language in there. So it's one of those where it's not attractive, and they jack up premiums. So the question is, okay, recognizing that cyber is not attractive right now, how do we make it more attractive? I could say, okay, we're willing to take a higher retention, but how high? And it's really what I found is kind of the packaging. That if we, all right, it's not just cyber we're selling, it's going to be an integrated program where it's all lines. It's, you know, PL, GL. That way, the carrier can rest assured that you're not just covering cyber in a bubble, you're covering our program. It's an integrated program because to us, if we have a loss, it's going to affect us in similar ways. If it's cyber, if it's, you know, E&O, D&O. So we're going to package these together, and the likelihood is, one, we won't have a loss, or two, if we have a loss, it's not going to be a loss in each of these. It's going to be maybe one, and the premiums paid on all of them will help cover the cost of that to the carrier.
I was just curious, for the insurance market, the people that offer cyber liability, is there consideration of those programs to say, okay, we'll cover you at this rate, and it'll be X, or we'll cover you at this rate, that's Y, if you adopt our security program and we can audit and monitor, et cetera? I know that increases cost overall, but is that something that's happening in the industry?
You know, a little. I've seen it a little bit, but not really, because the carriers are not. Once they do that, suddenly they're kind of putting themselves on the hook more so than before. They'd rather kind of be, you know, a little bit of double dutch. They'll jump in when they're ready and jump out when they're done. If they put these things and say, if you do this, you know, that's fine. But the reality is, if you do that at that day and time, that may be fine. But tomorrow, you're already back at risk. So I've not seen many carriers willing to make that kind of commitment. I have seen some that are willing to implement, you know, premium savings if you do this and audit, but it's really more of an obligation rather than, oh, we'll discount the premium. It's, if you don't have these standards, it's you're not covered. But again, on the integrated program, a lot of times that can help soften the blow if you have a carrier that's willing to cover cyber in addition to the other ones. Because again, the likelihood is you're not going to have a loss in all the layers, so those other layers can help subsidize any loss in the cyber and make the cyber look more attractive. So instead of getting $1 million in premium, they're getting $20 million in premium, and then therefore they can look at cyber a little differently based on the upside of the other coverages. The other ones, I've had programs looking at kind of multi-year single limit, kind of the same approach, that the likelihood is, are you going to have a loss in all your different lines in the same year? Are we likely going to have a significant loss in consecutive years, or are what we really worried about a significant loss, and those on average hit every 5-10 years, that those are the ones that we're concerned about? We're comfortable self-insuring or having a comprehensive self-insurance program. The sleep insurance is really the catastrophic stuff that doesn't hit all lines every year or any line in any particular consecutive years. So let's make sure we're buying what we need and not more than what we need. And on those programs, both kind of with the integrated and the single limit, what is often done is they say, okay, how many years have we bought, you know, 80 million towers with 50 million, all these different lines that we haven't used. Let's aggregate it, have a single line, and the likelihood is if we use it, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to hit that tower, but also pre-negotiate a reinstated limit. So basically you go and say, all right, $100 million limit across all lines, integrated program over X year, you know, 2 years. And if we get within 20% of that limit, we can reinstate it for this premium. That way, essentially what you're doing is trying to avoid buying more limits than you need, because the likelihood is you're not going to have all those losses across all those lines, but also kind of hedging your bets and saying, if we're wrong, we'll pre-negotiate a reinstatement of the limit. So essentially, we're before any losses have been incurred, we know what it would cost to reinstate those if we want to go back and buy more limits. Again, it's not one that any particular strategy, it's just a question of how you make your program look more attractive in light of the fact that people are becoming more and more skittish around things like cyber coverage. For what insurance you can't buy, really, this is one where, you know, healthcare providers and plan, we've been dealing with this for a while, that the whole idea of, you know, the insurance isn't available, or we've been dealing with that for, you know, 40, 50, 60 years or longer. Determine the best approach depending on what the risk is and how significant it is. Do you pay it as you go? Is it one of those you're just happy with the, you know, treating it as a line item, and if the expense comes up, you just pay it out of general operating? Or is it something that's significant enough that you really need to pre-fund? Figure out what your exposure is, set aside funds, whether in a self-insurance trust or a captive vehicle, because then you can say, if we can't buy the insurance, we don't have any choice but to self-insure. And if we have no choice but to self-insure, let's set aside funds. And the other question is, even if you can buy insurance, are we comfortable self-insuring because we can do it more efficiently? That people are scared about risk and we're comfortable with it, maybe naive to a certain extent, but we're comfortable with it. Can we self-insure more efficiently than the market is providing it? And then on the self-insurance side with a captive, one of the benefits you get there is, in some cases, it opens up different markets, because there's carriers that are allowed to write insurance, and there's carriers that are only allowed to write reinsurance. So with a captive, it's a licensed insurance vehicle in some domicile. So what you get access to is, in some cases, a broader market of the people that can only write reinsurance. So Lloyd's is a good example. A number of those carriers are only licensed as reinsurers. So while they couldn't come direct and place it, if you have a captive, you can write in the captive, they'll reinsure it. So sometimes if you can't buy the insurance, a broader market, broader terms become available simply by accessing the reinsurance market as opposed to direct insurance. So that's the point there. But again, if it's your risk, you know, that doesn't, just because you can't get it doesn't mean, well, you know, we're on it anyway. It's still important and even more critical to make sure you have the monitoring, mitigation, or remediation in place. I mean, that really goes without saying, because insurance or not, it's your risk. And if you're on the hook for financials anyway, it's really your risk. And this is, any questions on, because I want to transition, the two main ones, kind of cyber, and then the last one was stop loss. I just had a couple of comments on stop loss because it's becoming more and more prevalent in the discussion. Any questions on cyber? Okay, the other one that's coming up in meetings quite frequently is stop loss. And it's not a new coverage, but as healthcare has evolved, and there's more, you know, employer, provider, and plan risk, people are looking at ways to try to mitigate the volatility in there. That there's uncertainty, they don't know what it looks like, so they say, well, how do we balance on our balance sheet? Because what ends up happening is, you know, you take losses on the provider side, and then it's almost exacerbated by, you know, losses that you take on the plan side, because a lot of times you're doing similar things or similar strategies. So what has ended up happening is there's more and more stop loss programs where people are saying, listen, we're self-funding our employee benefits. We're taking risk on our provider contracts, and our health plans are exposed. And what I'm seeing is comprehensive stop-loss programs that sit above all those layers. Now, they don't have to. They could sit over one of those layers. They could sit over, you know, two. They could sit over all three. But what it's a way for providers and plans to basically say, okay, what are we really worried about? Where is there a layer where there's stability, and where can we take the volatility out that helps us mitigate that volatility and the impact it would have? And they set that up where they either run it through their captive and access reinsurance or run it directly through the stop-loss market, and they can take that volatility out. Again, with respect to their employee population, their provider risk under the provider contracts, and even the plan. The plan you need to be a little bit, you know, pay particular attention to, because the plan is a, you know, regulated vehicle, so there'll be a lot more scrutiny on the arrangements with the stop loss on what's going on there. But the plan is a lot of times where the emphasis is to try to pull out that volatile risk and stabilize the profitability. Is there anyone, the stop loss program, is anyone pretty familiar? Is there anyone that's been, has anyone looked at those frequently or recently?
A lot of our plans use those, especially for self-funded, but it probably is not the group that's here today that would be the ones looking at either selling that or adding that to coverage.
Okay.
We just did a webinar on the 12th, so Tuesday, on stop loss. And so you can go out and take a look at the presentation. Summit Re did it for us.
Yep. Summit Re, Partner Re, all very... very good partners. There's a number of them out there, and they're becoming better and better. I remember when I first got a stop-loss contract 10 years ago, it was essentially a professional liability reinsurance contract that they just referred to as stop-loss. And I said, no, that doesn't work. We need to get a little bit more up to speed understanding the risk that we're covering here. But, you know, that's basically, you know, high level on kind of what I'm seeing. I can get a little bit more into detail on the most concerning risks if we're interested in that piece, but a lot of that's on the provider side as opposed to the plan side. So I can stop and pause for questions if anyone has them.
I think it's probably on either the second or third slide. You mentioned there's a coverage for reputation. Go back probably a little bit.
Oh,
we were just
the
there.
Oh. There we go.
Yes. The one
yep.
Below regulatory.
Yep.
So is that normal? Is it common now for?
No. It's developing, and it's developing based on all the breaches and how much. The problem is when a coverage is developed as a result of people being terrified based on what's happening, it's one of those where as it's developing, it keeps getting pushed further and further away because the carriers are trying to figure out how to get their arms around it and how to price it, and mm-hmm. the people are running to it. So it's one of those where it's available, but it's a question of what's covered and how significant the coverage and at what price. Because when you try to figure out what the reputational damage is, it's one of those where it's very early on, and I'd be kind of reluctant to buy it at this point just because it's not very tangible, kind of what's covered, how you evaluate the reputational risk. But I am seeing it discussed more and more as something that's a material risk to the organization and therefore something that the market is looking to have a response to. Okay.
So there are carriers selling the product?
It's out there. I've not had anyone buy it yet. I've had brokers discuss it, but I've not seen a policy yet.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if this is a... It's a new coverage, but again, nothing that I've seen placed. But it's something that, you know, it's something worth discussing to figure out if you can get a policy in front of you, figure out exactly what would be covered. Because it all arises kind of in connection with other coverages. So the question is really, what is it attached to? Is it a rider to cyber? Is it a rider to another policy? So I've seen it discussed at a number of meetings by brokers as something they're looking at, something they're encouraging clients to look into, but not actually seeing the policy to get my arms around what exactly the placement would be or how you evaluate what is covered.
Okay, good. I know you're talking about insurance. Probably my question is kind of out of the scope, but I just want to throw there. Do you also have some resource for reinsurance?
Yes. Yeah, no, so on the reinsurance, so basically what I do is I serve as kind of general outside counsel to organizations in setting up their insurance programs. And when I say insurance programs, I mean comprehensive. So your self-insurance, either generally or underneath your commercial insurance, your commercial insurance, and your reinsurance. Because what's important there is to figure out, depending on how your self-insurance and your insurance is written, if you're buying reinsurance, the question really comes up, is that your buy or is that the commercial carrier's buy? In some cases, if it's on them, we really don't care. But if it's our program or our captive buying reinsurance, we really want to make sure we know how those coordinate.
I guess my next question is, what is your experience dealing with large, like a single large medical claim, like one claimant? So if you have one member that has a claim exceed multiple million, typically, what is the strategy to address those type of scenario?
You're talking about a large medical,
yes,
medical plan loss?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess I don't understand.
Are you talking about how do you deal with that when it's from the health plan perspective? Or?
Yes, from free insurance.
Okay, so you had mentioned reinsurance. We have two reinsurers that we work with, Summit Re and RBS Re. And typically on a large reinsurance, you'll have a deductible that you meet, and there's an aggregate and an individual case deductible. Mm-hmm. And then when you've met your aggregate, then your reinsurance kicks in. So say if your aggregate is 20 million, then once it's over 20 million in total claims, then the reinsurance kicks in on top of that as you're going through it. And so where you attach that depends on how many lives you're covering, what types of product lines you're in, what kind of requirements the state may have around that. So you tend to see lower reinsurance rates on Medicare Advantage because they don't have the big claims like a NICU baby, mm-hmm, you know, or something like that. Do you have lifetime claim? There used to be a lifetime limit on claims. Now that's been taken away with ACA. So there's all kinds of ways to look at it. One of the things that the partners we've used, especially Summit Re, they'll come in and they'll look at your strategic business approach and what you want to do, and they'll sit down with you and say, you know, here's the kind of coverage that you would probably need to look at or what you need to do with that. So often plans, if they're using a broker to purchase reinsurance, they get a spreadsheet and then here's what it is you want. They're not necessarily going to have that strategic discussion with you. So if you're looking for it, we can put you in touch with Brian Fellhopper. He'll come in and look at that and have a discussion. I remember one of our plans was thinking about getting into self-funded coverage, and they hadn't done it before. And he just spent a whole day with them saying, it's a different type of coverage, it's a different type of insurance, it's not your money, it's their money, you have to do all these kind of things. And they literally backed off of offering that for another year until they could get the processes in place that they needed to do. So, you know, it would be walking through what you currently have and what you're looking for.
That's, yeah, I apologize. I misunderstood your question, but that's exactly right. There's no way to answer that question without understanding kind of what you're doing, how you're doing it, what your population is. It's the reinsurance is there, and kind of how it goes through this hour is entirely dependent on, you know, where it is, what plan it's in, what the underlying. But you need to make sure, especially on that side, I said brokers are important on, you know, various coverage. That's one where they really need to understand kind of what you're doing to figure out what the best reinsurance structure is, because there's a lot of different moving parts there that if you get it wrong, there's not really a clear way out.
The other thing with reinsurers is you're not just looking for what's the cheapest coverage, you're looking for what's the right coverage, and there's always somebody in that market that comes in, buys the business, is there for a couple of years, then goes out and goes on, and then you're trying to collect. And so that's the other thing I would say, just be careful, because we've seen lots of companies come and go over the 27 years we've been in this, and part of the reason we selected the partners we did was because of the stability of who they were working with.
So I'm sorry, I may have missed this, but on the stop-loss side, what are you seeing issues on there? Are they denying if they don't get proper notification or any thing that we need to be watching for?
On the stop loss side, it's more just making sure you understand kind of your programs and what you're buying, and that it's consistent with what you're, you know, what you intend. Understanding how the tower works, what your retentions are, is there coinsurance all the way up,
okay,
what your obligations are as opposed to their obligations, when those kick in.
Okay.
So it's more just understanding your program. On the stop loss side, it was more kind of coordinating the coverage to figure out if there's efficient ways to buy it across multiple towers, whether it's multiple plans or it's the provider risk, the employer risk, and the plan risk, coordinating that way, because that can sometimes help, you know, take the volatility out of the organization as a whole by spreading it across the multiple areas that have a similar risk profile.
Okay. Thanks. Scott, thank you. I thought you did a good job. Everyone stayed awake.
Thank you.